Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And even though if you're watching the video version of this, you're still seeing two boxes of people in a standard Zoom call that we've all come to abhor, we are actually geographically much closer than usual because Ann has come out from Los Angeles to join me on the East Coast for the first in-person film festival in North America, according to Andrew Cuomo, although I believe it's maybe just the biggest. And that's the Tribeca Film Festival, which has started. And it's exciting, I have to say, just because I feel like I'm back in the thick of a big, crazy festival experience and contemplating the value of that more than ever before. How's it going for you so far?
I just love being in New York.
Welcome home.
I'm a New Yorker. I started out here. I grew up in Puerto Rican Harlem on 110th Street and Columbus Avenue across from the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I was married at the cathedral on the grounds. So I love New York and I missed it. I've been, it has been withheld from me for over a year and a half. So I am eager and happy to experience everything. And I just love it, even if it's hot and muggy. And one of the things I love about the opening night of Tribeca, the In the Heights movie, which I was seeing for the second time, was when you look at the movie, it's tactile. You feel the heat. You feel the...
It's certainly, yeah, I mean, it is a good time for this movie to be looked at. In a New York context, the movie is basically all about how hot it is outside and everyone trying to, survive the sweltering heat. I mean, the blackout that's at the center of the narrative. Yeah, I mean, it's all about that. And it has deep metaphorical connotations. But yeah, great New York movie. Certainly the best opening movie Tribeca's ever had as far as back as I can remember. And the biggest, a huge deal and a fascinating opening night experience because we were in totally different parts of the city. You were way down in Battery Park. I was in the Heights.
There is a line from Battery Park to Washington Heights. That's what we were doing.
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating to sort of get this sense of who was at which screening. It sounded like even though I was at the actual physical premiere with it had the cast and all that stuff, but it sounds like
I didn't get into.
They were pretty exclusive about the
your ticket.
Yeah.
So anyone who got to go to that one was like, well, you got into the big screening. I'm an interloper from LA, and as such, I settled for Battery Park. But it was great. There were these nice lean back lawn chairs, basically the wooden slatted kind. Maybe they were plastic versions, and you could put your cup down, you could put your sandwich down, and they were all spaced in a good way. And there was a great big beautiful screen, and it was except for when it was quiet, which is when you heard all the generators going
back to the heat.
Yeah, I'm keeping all the lights on or whatever they needed to service. And then there was the occasional siren or whatever. But as it got dark, that is a great looking movie. On the second viewing, I actually think even under those, this is not the best way to see the movie. The best way to see the movie, I urge everyone, is to go to a movie theater. But it's actually a gorgeous looking movie.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you about my experience, because what was so strange about it was, so I assumed we were on the same timeline, that the intros would be simulcast and stuff. And then you were writing me in an hour before the movie that I was watching was out, because ours started an hour late. And I think it's because of red carpet craziness out front. We had Lin-Manuel Miranda. We had, John M. Chu and all the cast, Anthony, where that was their real red carpet. And it was a huge scene outside the United Palace theater, because obviously in that neighborhood, it is the neighborhood of the movie, and Lin-Manuel Miranda is a god there. So you had a really complex kind of Latino turnout of fans, and then they probably interfaced with them to some degree. In the theater, we're like sitting there. I saw a couple journalists, some other industry folks around, and just waiting for it to start. You start to realize that we're in a different climate right now. People were walking in. You showed your proof of a vaccination at the door and sat down, and everyone took their masks off, like being at a restaurant. So while you were out it was spaced. We were socially distant. I was seated in a seat and saw another journalist I knew like two seats away from me. So they did space us out, but people took the masks off when they sat down, like you do at a restaurant.
But we were outdoors.
Right, and you were outside. So there was that first phase of just kind of sitting in the movie theater for an hour or so and being like, okay, I'm in a crowded area and looking at who's in the aisles, and there goes a famous person. And, you know, that part of the experience starts to come back. Then we get into the intros, you know, De Niro and Rosenthal as the heads of the festival do their whole shtick. Toby Emmerich from Warner Brothers came out and introduced the movie.
It was a real premiere.
Yeah, and he pointed out...
in its success.
Yeah, well,
what this is, it's a launch. It's a marketing launch.
Yep, they needed it. They need that for the movie.
All five boroughs, all over the city, there were word of mouth spreading out of these screenings.
And for all the speculation about the future of Warner Brothers and all the shifts going on with Warner Brothers Discovery now, it does feel like they're leaning into the idea that they have something really special here that they can take some credit for. And Emmerich also pointed out Ann Sarnoff, who was in the audience at the screening. So they did try to really create a real show of force behind, you know, what they're launching here, and holding on to the movie for a year as opposed to trying to push it out earlier or put it just on VOD was a smart gamble. Here's what I would say. I've seen the movie twice now too. You've seen it twice on a big screen. I saw it once on a small screen, and then saw it last night on opening night on a big screen. I would tell people, if you can't see this movie on a big screen, don't even bother. I honestly had such a better experience on every level experiencing the movie. Obviously the crowd was really lively. I saw a couple
notes. I want to know. I mean, did they all applaud after the opening number?
Opening number was huge, but not just it. It was like the moment that you see, you know, specific characters pop up on screen, or like there's a wink and nod to Hamilton. Like the crowd response on that kind of stuff was big, but also just the scale of it. Like when I watched, there's a great 96,000 is one of the better known songs in the musical, and it's been staged at a pool. When I watched a pool scene at home on my TV, it felt like very busy and kind of cluttered, honestly, and maybe a little too heavily edited. I wouldn't say it's a perfect sequence, but it's a lot more fun on the screen because of that, because there's so many dancers and it's edited in a way where there's so much happening. And John M. Chu, you know, he directed the Step Up movies and stuff. Like, he needs that big canvas to make that work, and it does work.
Exactly what he's doing. I was very aware of it on the second viewing, that editing is crucial to this, especially those big musical numbers, because he's got, if you think about it, he has many, 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 many setups. And even in that opening number, when I was thinking about it, Anthony Ramos, first of all, it's all pre-recorded, of course, it has to be. But Anthony Ramos, he has to just do little tiny bits as if it's the most natural thing in the world. And they all pull it off. There's a lot of direct to the camera setups and a lot of point of views. And one of the things they do in the pool sequence is they take the wonderful dancer who plays his love interest and put her in a bikini on from above on it's Busby Berkeley, basically, in a naturalistic kind of edited way,
which is a bold move, right? Because for those of us who treasure, you know, Footlight Parade or whatever, it's like, how dare you take that imagery and repurpose it? You know, it's it's tricky to you know, recycle stuff.
But they're great. The only weakness, I believe, I'm curious to hear what you would say. The great movie musicals somehow tell stories with every single song. And as much as I love these songs and the music itself, there were times in terms of the pacing of the movie that I felt like they weren't necessarily progressing in the way that I would want them to. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think that's a key factor that goes back to In the Heights itself, which unfortunately I didn't see when it was on stage. But this is a pre-Hamilton work, right? I mean, it was his student project at Wesleyan, and it's certainly strong in certain ways from a representational standpoint, from a narrative standpoint, in the sense that it's tapping into the nature of a community with a lot of different Latinos from different backgrounds,
and a lot of ground
wrestling with that.
Serious about its immigration themes.
Yeah, but story wise, it's actually a relatively small scale story in spite of the ensemble component, and that's a tension that it's never fully resolved. So you come out of the movie less thinking about what happened than just some individual kind of spectacular moments and the magical realism of it.
That the talent is breaking out the way they are. Anthony Ramos will be a much bigger star. He may be nominated for an Oscar. The woman who's the abuela may be nominated as well. She was very strong. And I think it could get some tech nominations as well, including cinematography and editing. It's going to come out very well at the end of the day, I think.
Well, it's certainly the launch that
it, which I think it will be.
It's the first kind of theatrical launch since the start of this weird world we've been living through that actually feels like it has a lot of potential for long-term success as a theatrical event movie. I don't remember what percentage of movie theaters have opened now at this point. I think it's 60% or something a little bit more than that at this point. But it does seem like we're starting to see progress in terms of people feeling comfortable going to the movies again. So they just need a reason to go. This is not just propaganda. It is a reason to go to a movie because it takes advantage of what a movie theater can do in a way. Like, you will almost certainly get your money's worth from a pure, like, visceral point of view.
And by the way, Kate Gerbland did a good story this week about how some of the feel-good movies are playing well around all the different platforms. And I would certainly put this in the category of an exuberant feel-good movie. I really hope it does well.
Yeah, and it'll be fascinating to see where we go from here, right? Because we're heading into a pretty complicated summer. I mean, F9, which we now know it's going to have its French premiere at Cannes, it's getting, you know, not maybe
it's
the
my screening in LA, so I might have to see it.
I still haven't seen it either. There are a couple of other screenings coming up. Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, if we go, you look at the paradigm of In the Heights and the paradigm of F9, they're not the same kind of reason you go to a movie theater, but they're both pretty convincing cases. In some ways, like, F9 doesn't have to be as satisfying as In the Heights for audiences to feel like it was worth the trip. You know, okay, they went to space, we got to see it, it was fun, and maybe they were like not totally paying attention all the time and it doesn't matter. That's a kind of passive movie going experience. Like, I'll take a passive movie going experience like that over like the passive movie going experience where you watch something at home and you're looking at your phone every 5 minutes or whatever. So I feel like that those two plus Black Widow being right around the corner is a very powerful.
I'm very eager to see it. Now, look, what am I rooting for? I'm rooting for F9 to be huge. I'm rooting for theaters to survive. I'm rooting for theaters all over the world to pull in crowds. Needless to say, I am not rooting against F9. I'm just saying it's not my cup of tea.
And what are you thinking about Black Widow? Because we've talked about this before. It's kind of like this strange thing with Disney putting it on premium VOD and theaters at the same time. But
I wrote a little piece in the New York Times about this.
Just a little thing in the op-ed section of the New York Times.
I do think that it's a big deal that Disney is withholding certain films from exclusive theatrical runs, and I think they shouldn't be, and I think they should be supporting the theaters. But as a number of people have pointed out to me, each of these studios has a different set of concerns that they're dealing with. Some of them are pulling out some numbers to from the pandemic and all the setbacks that they had during the pandemic, some of them are trying to woo Wall Street and make Wall Street impressed with what they're doing. And so there's all sorts of different factors that play into why these decisions are made, which I respect. But I do think the short term should not hurt the theaters. And that is what worries me. There is a definite ecosystem that is threatened right now, even if AMC is pretending that they are part of an alternate reality.
AMC lives on Reddit forums now, apparently. I think that's sort of their big model for success going forward. But I'm fascinated to see how the next month and change goes as we head into Cannes in that respect, because Cannes is such a, you know, theaters must survive kind of entity, and they're so invested in that, and that's why an F9 in some ways fits into that narrative. That's why they have that in tandem with, you know, French Dispatch and all these other kind, like it's sort of designed around this idea of the big screen being so essential to launching these films, and we're not really seeing an alternative in the summer ecosystem. Like, it's not like there's a bunch of movies coming up that aren't going to need the big screen to break through the noise. TV can. We had Mayor of Easttown a few weeks ago do that, but I don't really see.
Here's the problem that worries me a lot. When I did some reporting on this story, it was clear to me that it was actually the art houses and the specialty distributors that were in more of a, I mean, the studio specialty distributors have other ways of getting their money back, but the true indies, some of the indies like Neon and A24 have partnerships with streamers, so they can figure out. IFC obviously has its own way of getting its movies out there that's also online. But it's a real tricky wicket to get people to come to theaters. And the reason for that is partly that the Mayor of Easttowns and the streamers, all of those titles have so much noise, and there's so many of them. There's such a plethora of choices that to cut through the clutter with marketing, it's very difficult. And it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of muscle. And like in The Heights, like what Warner Brothers is doing with that movie. And that's why they're doing it. That's why they picked Tribeca.
If you look at, I mean, I'll be curious to see what the numbers are, if we ever get some sense of the numbers for In the Heights on HBO Max, right? Because that's an option people will have. And if you look at the interviews that John M. Chu has been doing about the, he hasn't done like Denis Villeneuve or one of these people and like lashed out at that, you know, the hand that fed him in that sense. But it's coded, right? There's definitely an ongoing frustration with this, because unless you have In the Heights, you can't really make a compelling case that this is the only way you should see this movie. But if In the Heights can't do it, nothing can in this particular moment that we're in. Maybe Black Widow, but Black Widow, people are going to watch that faster.
Too, that we're talking about F9 and Black Widow will probably be much bigger, and much bigger globally. In the Heights is probably more American, I would suggest.
Yeah, you might be right, but I mean, I don't know if...
And people have to like musicals, which is another subset, too.
No, that's a fair point. I think, though, that Black Widow, because of the PVOD, what I think is problematic about that is that in our particular information culture, it's like people want answers ASAP. They want information ASAP. You Google something when you want to know it. And the Marvel universe is all built around like instant gratification. We want to know what happens in this movie. Didn't she die in that other one? So is it just an origin story, or what's going to happen? So they're just going to, if they can spend the money at home, they're just going to watch it as soon as they can. I don't think most people are inclined
there
to go out for that.
There is some evidence that at least with Cruella, for example, that there's arguments pro and con that they lost $10 million or so in theatrical box office, but what did they make when they were able to collect all the revenue per PVOD on Disney Plus? And, you know, did they in the overall scheme of things lose money? And there's an argument that some people are making that there's a bigger audience that will consume these movies and that everybody can thrive. And I think Tom Brueggemann is making that argument as well, that there's a day and date argument. Give everybody what they want. Let them choose which venue they want to be in. I worry about that. I think it's better to have at least a 3-week exclusive window in theaters to build the brand. But with these big, big branded movies, they don't need to build the brand.
Well, I was thinking about this also while watching In the Heights last night. I mean, it's fascinating to go back and have this mindset of what the past year has meant, where you just didn't have the luxury of the big screen experience. So you couldn't pretend that it was the only way to watch a movie because you just didn't have that option. And I was just thinking about, you know, if you didn't have that nostalgic fixation on the big screen that got you excited about movies in the first place, which is multiple generations of people at this point, do you really feel like this is such an essential experience? Are you automatically going to understand that? I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. And I feel more and more like theatrical has to make that case each time out.
So there's the frequent moviegoer that we all know about. The frequent moviegoer, often younger, but sometimes older. The older moviegoer is the threatened species back in the theaters because they've gotten used to the convenience of watching at home. And they it's a schlep, you know? And that's why I'm worried about the specialty box office. If you think about a movie like Christian Petzold's Undine.
Undina,
which I liked much more than you did. I would say to you, it's shocking how badly that did in theaters. A name auteur, somebody that people should be able to recognize.
Well, but let me give you some other stuff. I mean, we look at the Cannes lineup. There's movies that I think, I mean, well, let's see how the Gaspar Noé film is received. If it's a crazy movie.
Always has something else going for it.
I think, yeah, but the challenge is getting, luring people back to the movie. If you're talking about art house, you're talking about something that really is a fully distinctive, unlike anything else out there, visionary experience that benefits from the theatrical context. Undina does, because Petzold is a very subtle director, but it's harder to make the case than I think something that is more viscerally involving or a big, you know, overt crowd pleaser or something
to that
effect.
Here's the problem with a movie like Undine, a perfect example, actually. If all the critics say it's not the best movie that Christian Petzold has ever made, a guy who has set a very high bar with Barbara and Phoenix and Transit, then they're not going to go. And that's a sad thing, I think.
Well, that's the challenge of living in a polarized society where it's like everybody is either like, you know, yes or no. Rotten Tomatoes tells us rot or fresh, and fresh or rotten.
By the way, if you look at Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes on this movie, they're fresh. It's very fresh.
Right, but I mean,
it's not a home run in the 80s somewhere.
Yeah, people want to see something that is either just yes
like
or no.
75 or something.
Yeah, exactly. And if you see something in the 70s, even though we use letter grades in our reviews, I always have had some misgivings about them because of that, because people just want to know something that just reduces the information to whether or not it's worth their time, as opposed to giving you some context and then allowing you to sort of make your own sort of consumer decisions, you know, by thinking things through. That's just not the society that we live in right now. And that was a challenge without the pandemic. You know, it's hard to figure out what's worth your time.
So we worked together on a story about the festivals and what's going on and how things are proceeding forward. And it was sort of a fun story to navigate. So we've talked about Tribeca. One of the things about Tribeca I would suggest is that it's a little disorganized, at least from the perspective of a member of the press coming from out of town and trying to get information about.
And you're one of the precious few. It's not like this is a festival that attracts a lot of out-of-town press. So
I know other people on the staff have had a tough time figuring out, you know, how to get their pass and what it gives them and where to go. And so I guess we'll get it together eventually. But it's not exactly, you know, we're not being handheld here. And then the other thing that's coming up, of course, is Cannes, which I guess the safety protocols are still an issue there. Some people are saying we do have to get even if we're double vaxxed, that we have to get a test before we get on a plane.
It seems that is the direction that things are heading. But fortunately for Americans, and that's an important distinction, we don't have to quarantine when we arrive. The big challenge that Cannes faces is that this is a festival that is international, not only in terms of its programming, but in terms of the different industries it attracts. And this year, for industry and press from countries in South America or Africa, certain parts of Asia. If you're going to go, you have to quarantine for like 2 weeks. A lot of people aren't going to do that, and they have to get special permission to get around that, and a lot of people won't be able to. So that is a big challenge for a festival that thrives on an international presence, does not want to be a localized festival in any respect.
So it's going to be a pared down, very small group that we're all going to see each other for dinner every night.
I mean, I'm excited about that part of it, back into it.
We'll be the stalwart crew, assuming we all do make
it. Yeah, and there will be a European presence. We can expect to hear a bit more about how industries in France and Italy and a couple other places are working to sort of restart and deal with their own challenges. So I think that's going to be exciting. Cannes has added a couple films to the lineup. It's a stacked official selection. I mean, other festivals tend to program more movies, but Cannes usually has like 50 odd movies already. We're into the mid 60s now, and you never know what else might pop up in there. So I mean, it's a very discerning curatorial approach. Doesn't mean there can't be bad movies, but
I have no worries about the lineup and all the films we're going to see. And there's certainly plenty of people for us to interview, and we'll have more access to them. I suspect there will be less, you know, we will be having dinner at night, because I think there will be less parties, that kind of thing.
You know, and I don't know. Let's back up a second.
Yeah.
I didn't get into it, but there was a party for In the Heights. I believe it was not an official Tribeca party. That Tribeca is not, you know, putting on a big show in that respect. But there was a party at this place in not too far from the theater at the Hudson, and I was in a crowded movie theater where movie stars introduced the movie and they weren't wearing masks, and I was, you know, milling about crowds and seeing people and all that, and it made me realize that this is as long as there's a possibility of having the events and gatherings and so forth, they're gonna happen. So I would not rule out the possibility that Cannes will have parties.
Cannes,
that there
full
it
rooftops,
could be more.
It's full of beaches.
It could be more social than we realize.
But
I think.
Imagine, for example, one of the great parties every year is the Toronto party. Because of the timing of the festival, because it's in July, we won't be going to a Toronto party. And the fate of the Toronto Film Festival is very much up in the air, as Canada has had much more trouble getting their population vaccinated in the kind of way that we have in the US and in the UK. And Ontario itself is sort of politically hampered. And we may not be able to go to, as Americans, to Toronto physically, and they'll have to be a version of the festival they did last year. I understand it's bigger than the one last year, smaller than the usual footprint, and it will be on the model of last year, but things could change. If we get an opening and we can go, I'm sure they will welcome us.
And that leads us into the fall season, the open question, because obviously it was very discombobulated last year. We had the hybrid TIFF New York, which was mostly online and drive-ins. So not really hybrid. I mean, the drive-ins were cool, but that's a different kind of experience. And then Telluride just chose to cancel, because like, what's the point of a festival like that being online, really? So now it's a totally different story, right? Because only Toronto seems like it could be a similar setup to last year. It's very likely that New York Film Festival is going to be a big indoor thing. I mean, I've already been to a big indoor New York Film Festival event. So they're looking pretty good. And then Telluride seems like really in good shape to come back and be big.
They're both going to benefit, unfortunately, at Toronto's expense, because the people who book these events, the Hollywood talent is already back in the trenches shooting all these movies that got backed up by the pandemic. Their schedules are very tight. They have to know where they're going and when, and they're going to book Telluride and New York at the expense of Toronto, which is too bad for Toronto. It's not their fault.
Yeah, I mean, Toronto will have to figure out how to, at the very least, even if it doesn't get the first of certain films, that it could somehow have, you know, a piece of it.
Some kind of virtual thing like they did last year.
And let's not forget, they did technically launch a couple movies last year. I mean, they had a movie we still haven't seen there, but because it was only in the drive-ins, but Halle Berry's directorial debut sold to Netflix for like $25 million at a TIFF last year.
Penguin now, Bloom also sold.
Yeah, exactly. So there were some, so there are some reasons to do it if it is more localized, but has the access to a wider array of press, it does give them a unique angle. It's just not as obvious as, say, the VIP Telluride experience, which is, you know, so clearly targeted to Oscar voters and so forth. So we know that'll just happen as it has before.
So what's going to happen in Cannes and which is going to be so important is that for buyers and people who are looking to pick up. By the way, the pattern so far is that a lot of these things are selling ahead of the festival. They're booked for Cannes, but people aren't waiting for how it plays in Cannes. They're scooping them up.
Why would the sales agents want to wait? I mean, it's such an unknown situation in terms of what you get out of it. So
it'll be the iffier, smaller titles that need to play with an audience and get well reviewed before they. What that means is that the market is starving for product, and they're picking things up sight unseen.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be
picking them up off of online screenings without waiting to see what the viewers think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a fascinating process of, you know, some of these films that were picked up early, you know, like Paul Verhoeven's Benedetta by IFC. Is that IFC basically, you know, saying that they see something in this that they can make work irrespective of how critics react? Do they have a strong idea of how critics will react, or is it something more just like they feel like they want to invest in a certain, you know, high bar of auteur cinema? I mean, there are different things you can take from that, but it doesn't have the festival context, so it changes the equation. So
what I would say there is that the combo of the buyer and the seller have figured out what they have projected what the likely scenario will be, and they have settled for what it is. This is a good way to go. In other words, if something that politically taboo, in terms of its sexual politics and religious politics, is definitely not going to be a mainstream studio venture.
Right, right. Whereas Sean Baker's new movie, which I'm told has all experienced actors, it's not first timers like he usually works with, including some porn actors, went to A24, which did Florida Project. So that was neat to see that, because, you know, now we have a new film we didn't even know was going to be part of the conversation at this time of year that has a buyer getting behind it who clearly has big plans for you know, the kind of impact they could have. So so I think it's going to be a fascinating experience to dig through a lot of these films, because when we see them in the context of Cannes, it's not just going to be about, you know, who's going to get this out. It's going to be, what did these buyers at this particularly perilous moment see about these films and decided, you know, that these films should be part of their strategy, aside from the fact that they obviously need stuff in their slate to put out into the world. So,
next up, live Screen Talk.
Yeah, we will get out of these tiny boxes into a real environment.
We'll see each other in person, hopefully more than then. I think we have other plans to connect, but I look forward to seeing you in the flesh, Eric.
So the second Friday of Tribeca, and I'm going to make sure I get the day right, because if I say it wrong, someone will get mad. June 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern, Screen Talk is going live at the Tribeca Film Festival. Ticketing information and all that stuff should be live shortly, if it's not already, and I don't know exactly what the capacity issues are with all that stuff, but if anyone is in the New York area and would like to go, we hope you make the effort to show up and heckle us in person. If not, you'll get a chance to listen to it afterwards. And Anne, I can't wait to see you around the city. We always have the best time out here. I know we've had some good times in LA. We've done a couple things there together, Oscars and so forth, but when we're on the home turf, you know, all bets are off. So I'll see you around soon, I hope.
Look forward. Okay.
Bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.